here. This chair is kind of comfortable, so if I doze off in the middle of the talk, that's why. Let me tell you, for those of you who weren't here last night, or for those of you who may not remember, let me start off by telling you the story so far. You know, that as Andre was saying, we started at the beginning. We started at the beginning, and what better starting place than to start with ourselves? We started with we. What we want to finish up with, but not today, what we want to finish up with tomorrow, is that we are the crisis of capital, and proud of it. So we started yesterday with we, with the argument that the starting point is really very important. Starting point is very important because if we start with domination, or if we start with structures, then there's a great danger, I think, that we enclose ourselves, that we entrap ourselves within the structures of domination that we want to criticize. Once we create a framework of domination for ourselves, for our own thought, our own argument, really there's no way out, I think. It's very important, I think, to start with the force that can break those structures. It's important to start with something that isn't closure, with something that's openness, with breaking. In other words, it's important to start with ourselves. And I made various points about we. Very briefly, firstly, we are dignity. We are not victims. We are dignity, and we are enraged dignity. We are digna rabia, as the Zapatistas put it. Secondly, that we are richness. We are the rich. We are not the poor. It is not because we are poor that we rebel. It is because we are rich, because we have in us the enormous richness of undefined creativity. And it is because this richness and this dignity is incarcerated within the forms of capitalism, within the commodity form, that we rise up and say, no, we will not accept it. We don't start from the poor, we start from the rich. We don't start from being victims, we start from our own dignity. We are dignity, we are richness. We are the only creators of this society, and therefore we are the creators upon whom capital depends. We are in rebellion. Otherwise, I don't know why you would be here this evening if you weren't in some sense in rebellion. And we're in rebellion not because we're special. Our rebellion doesn't make us different from all those masses who didn't come this evening. We are in rebellion because we are ordinary. That I said is the greatest challenge of the Zapatistas, is they say we are perfectly ordinary people, therefore we are rebels. We are ordinary, and we are ordinary dignities, and our politics is the politics of trying to articulate and recognize the dignities of all of us. And that leads us to certain ideas about political organization. It leads us to considering ourselves part of the great anti-capitalist tradition that goes back to the very origins of anti-capitalism, that understands organization in terms of assemblies, in terms of councils, in terms of Soviets, in terms of communes, in terms of organizing in a way that tries to articulate our anger and doesn't think about organization from an instrumental point of view as simply how to gain power. We are self-contradictory and we are confused. We are self-contradictory because we must be, because our feet are caught in the mud of the society in which we live, even if our heads want to break away from it. Or perhaps it's the other way around. Perhaps it's our heads that are caught in the mud that of the society in which we live, and our feet want to get away from it and are already running. No? But in any case, the society, the contradictions of the society are bound to reproduce themselves within us. So that inevitably living in an antagonistic society means that we too are self-antagonistic. And that means that the concept or the very idea of revolutionary purity is a load of nonsense. And indeed, not just a load of nonsense, it is absolutely destructive. No. And that also leads us to, I think, to the idea that the only way forward is not by laying down the correct line, no, but the only way forward is, again, as the Zapatistas put it, asking we walk. We advance by asking. We advance by trying to connect with the other dignities that surround us, the other rebellions that surround us. We try and move forward through discussion, through hearing, through asking people about their rebelliousness, about their dignity. We misfit. We misfit into this society. And we misfit not because, or not only because we are weird people on the edges of society, but we misfit because misfitting is actually a central aspect of existence in a capitalist society, because a capitalist society is the pushing of human lives into forms within which we cannot possibly fit. No. Capital pushes our activity into the labor form. It pushes our interrelations with one another into the commodity form or into the money form. And it can't. It can't work. I mean, it can have a huge effect. It obviously does have a huge, disastrous, destructive effect. But it's not totally successful. It can't be totally successful. And if it were totally successful, we wouldn't have any way of talking about it. So we misfit. We exist. The very fact of existing within capitalist society means that we exist in, against, and beyond capitalist society. We exist in, and that is a huge effect on the way we think and what we do. And but we also inevitably exist against capitalist society, because the very fact of being forced to exist in it forces us to exist, to protest against it, to rebel against it, to reject it. So we exist against, in and against, but we also exist beyond capitalist society, because all the time we're trying to create something else, all the time we're trying to create forms of relating to other people that are more adequate to what we are, or what we think we are, or what we think we could be. So all the time we're kind of not only in, but we're also against, and we're also pushing beyond society, which means we don't fit in. We don't fit into any boxes, and we don't fit into any identities. So our politics, our anti-capitalism, our is inevitably an anti-identitarian politics. An anti-identitarian politics which says, fine, okay, we are women, or we are gay, or we are black, or we are Irish, or we are indigenous, but we are more than that. And if we don't say that, if we don't recognize how we spill over from our own identities, then it does seem to me that our language becomes too easily integrated, that it becomes, I would say, actually reactionary. But again, okay, just thought about the fifth time I've mentioned them, they shouldn't really keep on talking to them. But it seems to me that what's exciting about the Zapatista movement is not just that it's an indigenous movement. If it were just an indigenous movement, we'd say, oh, great, you know, very good, we'll show you our solidarity, good that you're doing that, fine. But no, it's not that. And they've said from the beginning, okay, we're a movement of mainly indigenous, almost of overwhelmingly indigenous in composition, but we're not just an indigenous movement. We're not just fighting for indigenous rights. We're actually fighting for humanity. Right? So from the beginning, it's a movement that spills over, consciously spills over from its own identity, and that's what makes them exciting. We overflow then. We overflow from our identities. And I think that means also that we are anti-institutional. If we exist in, against, and beyond, then it means that we are in movement. It means that we are not nouns. We are actually verbs. And we are movings. We are, I don't know what, doings. We are humanings. We're verbs. And that means, I think, that we are anti-institutional. Institutions try to convert our verbness into nouns, try to fix it, try to give it stability, trying to tie down our potentially unlimited becoming. And we finally, and this is, I suppose, what I came on to more in the discussion yesterday, we are doers against labour. Okay? We are not just labour, we are actually doers against labour. If we think of the way in which capital entraps our dignity, or imprisons our dignity, if we think of the way in which the commodity form or the money form incarcerates our richness, the richness of our potential, then we can say that the basis of that is actually that capital incarcerates our doing, our activity, and forces it into the form of a labor that produces value or contributes to the production of value, and therefore contributes to the production of capitalist profit. To say we are against capital, we absolutely have to say that we are against labour, in the sense that we are against capitalist labour. We are against what capital does to our activity as humans. And I think that's something that's actually becoming articulated more and more in the movements, in anti-capitalist movements over the last 15, 20 years, or 30 years, I don't know, is the idea that no, we cannot think of anti-capitalism simply as being the struggle of labour and capitalism. Simply the struggle of labour against capital. It is, in the first place, and must be, the struggle of doing against labour, against the labour that produces capital. Which doesn't mean, and perhaps I should emphasize that, it doesn't mean that our struggle is therefore outside the factory. In a way, on the contrary, well, not on the contrary exactly, but partly on the contrary, because if you think that the people who suffer most directly from the imposition of labor upon doing. If you think of the people who suffer most directly, most painfully from the subjection of their activity to the demands of labor that produces value or contributes to the production of value, then of course that means people who are employed, and including, I suppose, obviously people who are in the factories. So to say that our movement is the movement of doing against labor is not at all to say our movement is outside the factories, but that our movement, whether within or without or wherever, is a movement of doing against labor. It is a movement for the recuperation of our own, of recuperation of the self-determination of our own activity as humans. And that's really what it's all about, isn't it? And all this and all these points about we are really can be seen in terms of, it seems to me, not just kind of abstract ideas of a professor, but they're actually points that are emerging from social struggles and the way that changing forms of social struggle, anti-capitalist struggle, over the last 20 years or so. Okay, so that's the story so far. That's where we got to last night. What I want to do now is have a drink of water and then I'll carry on. As I was saying just now, really the idea, I suppose, for me, I think what these three evenings are about is really the trying to think through or trying to talk about a change that is taking place in the concept of revolution, a change that is taking place in the way we understand anti-capitalist struggle. And that has to be a discussion. It has to be a discussion because our ideas, and I think the ideas of everybody, are in the process of formation. What we can say, I think, is that the collapse of the Soviet Union and the emergence of China as an aggressive capitalist power have made very clear, I think, to almost everybody, what was already had been said for many years before that, namely that the revolutions in China, in Russia, were a failure, or that there was something wrong with the whole idea of revolution in the 20th century. And what these developments make clear is that there was something wrong. They can only be explained in terms of particular historical events. But there was something wrong in the way that people were talking about revolution. And of course, thousands and thousands and millions of people fought and devoted their lives to those ideas of revolution. And they devoted their lives to really trying to make the world a different place. They devoted their lives and their debts to a struggle to get rid of capitalism. And obviously, I think we are their heirs. And we have to take that very seriously. It kind of places a responsibility on us. And I think that responsibility is not to say, they were filthy Stalinists or Trotskyists or whatever. The responsibility on us is really to kind of pick up the banners that they have left fallen on the ground. And the only way that we can pick up those banners, I think, is saying, by going off in a slightly different direction or in a fairly different direction. The only way we can honor their memory is by saying, wow, you know, fantastic, wonderful, how you fought for a different society, but you were wrong. You were fantastic, but the way you thought about bringing the change. We have learned. We have learned from your experience. We have learned from the experience of the last century that that doesn't work. You know, and so to honor your memory, we have to take up the question of revolution again. But the only way we can take up the question of revolution is by rethinking what it means, by trying to reset the terms in a certain way. And I think what happened after the fall of the Soviet Union in China, was there was a kind of an initial reaction that said, well, revolution isn't really on the cards. And there's not much point in talking of revolution or thinking about revolution anymore. But of course, struggles are important. And that's not necessarily bad, because I think perhaps what happened is that people, instead of wasting their energies on building up the party or on fighting out sectarian disputes with other parties, of course that continued and continues, but I think that perhaps people started to put more energy into actually fighting local struggles or struggles about particular things, you know, struggles that really set out to change, improve the world, and in some cases have done so. But in that process, I think very often the whole question of revolution became lost. No? And I think we have to go back to the revolution, because it's not the idea of revolution, at least, because it's not just a question of improving, winning little victories here and there, you know, which we sometimes do, which we generally don't, you know. But it's not that. It's a question of how on earth do we break the dynamic of existing society? How on earth do we break the dynamic of capital, the dynamic of money that is causing such appalling destruction throughout the world, appalling destruction to our lives, appalling destruction to other forms of life, appalling destruction to everything. You know, how on earth do we break that dynamic? How do we go beyond, or how do we understand the particular struggles in the context of a possible dynamic, or a dynamic that seeks to break, or a push that seeks to break the dynamic of destruction? So I think we need to go back to the question of, well, you know, great, all these individual struggles, but what does revolution mean today? How can we actually think on, not just think from a professorial point of view, or from the point of view of a PhD or whatever, but how can we think on the basis of the development of struggles? How can we see a different conception of revolution being opened up? And for me, that takes us back. It takes us back in the first place. I think it takes us back from the first place to what I was saying yesterday about we. And we are dignity, and we are richness, and we are, etc., self-contradictory, and we are confused, and all the rest of it. Because when we start with we, the point is that we are starting with the forces of rupture. If we want to start and talk about how we're going to break the dynamic, then we have to talk about the forces, or the force that can break that dynamic. And I think it's no good, we said that yesterday as well, it's no good just to say, well, the working class will break the dynamic of capital, because that really doesn't help us to think anew. I think it doesn't help us to open up new questions or try and think about new way of posing the problems. I'm quite happy to say that the working class is the force that's going to break, it's the only force that can break the dynamic of capital, but so only if we question the meaning of working class, only if we say we have to understand working class then as the movement of doing against labour. In other words, if only if we understand working class, as the movement against its own existence as working class, then yes, perhaps. Yes, in fact. But okay, we have to go back then when we're talking about we were talking about the forces of rupture. We're talking about the force of doing against labor. We're talking, I think, and this is something I'm not going to develop, but I really think that I'd like to think about it. We're talking about understanding our richness, our dignity, our creativity, our doing as being the force of production. Now, in other words, rethinking the whole category of force of production, rethinking this whole conflict, you know, which is so embedded in the Marxist tradition of the whole rethinking the conflict between the forces of production and the relations of production, and saying, well, of course, we are the forces of production. Who else? Who else is going to create? It has to be we. We, not just here and now, but we and our fathers and our grandfathers and our great-grandmothers and our great-great-grandmothers, etc., etc. In other words, that we are part of a continuous development of human creativity. And that's surely what the forces of production is all about. So, in talking about we then, I'm not going to develop that, we can come back to it later. In talking about we as the force of rupture, okay, how is it that we can understand ourselves as the force that ruptures or that can rupture this terrible dynamic of destruction? Then I think one obvious thing to say is, well, we are. Of course we are. We know we are. But our ruptures, if you like, are volcanic ruptures. They're sporadic ruptures, they're occasional ruptures. They're ruptures that don't exist to the same intensity in all places and at all times. But if we look around us, or if we just look at the people in this room, then I'm quite sure that we can see how our force is the force of breaking here and there, is the force of cracking the texture of capitalist domination. That in all of us, in one way or another, break through the dynamic, the kind of the cohesive logic of capital, and say, well, no, sorry, we're not going to do things that way. You know, we're going to do something else. We're going to walk in the opposite direction. And you can think of these as I say, as being cracks in this kind of closely woven weave of domination within which we live. And you can think of those cracks when you then think, well, what cracks? What are they? And you think, well, okay, we can see some cracks easily enough. You know, we can see, again, I'm going to say that seven times tonight, the Zapatistas, okay, there. You go into the Zapatista area in Chiapas and you pass a sign, you know, that says, bad government, stay out. Here the people rule. Again, this is obviously a declaration that here in this territory, we are walking in the opposite direction. We're not going to let the government in, and we're not going to follow the logic of the government. We're not going to follow the logic of capital. We are going to organize ourselves in a different way. We are going to create an education that is different and pushes in the other direction. We're going to organize a system of healthcare that pushes in a different direction, a system of justice that doesn't slot in to the categories of capital. Well, obviously, there's a crack, you know, fantastic. Lovely crack that's been going for 20 years or more. And then You think, well, yes, but they're Mexicans, and they're far away, and they're indigenous. And then you think, well, what about Occupy Oakland, for example? You know, to come closer to home, I was being told about Occupy Oakland about half an hour ago. You know, wasn't that a crack? Wasn't that a space where people were saying not only no, not only some protesting, but actually trying to create something different, actually trying to walk in the other direction, actually trying to create different sorts of social relations, actually trying to work out in practice the basis for some new form or different form of social organization. So there you've got a medium-sized crack, if you like. Medium-sized crack that didn't last, that hasn't lasted perhaps for the 20 years that the Zapatistas have existed publicly, but there, yeah, of course it's an important crack. And then you think, well, okay, what about us? You know, what about us here tonight? What are we doing? What are we talking about? You know, we're not actually talking about how can we make a profit on our next essay or on our next dissertation or whatever. We're not talking about how do we slot into the system. We're talking about how can we go in the opposite direction? How can we think in the opposite direction? How can we think against capital? How can we give a force to our own thought against capital, our own rejection of capital? And you think, well, yes, that's nice. You know, okay, we're only going to last 3 days, perhaps. We're only going to last a few hours. But here we've got a crack, too. We're actually trying to push in the opposite direction. It's not because we have some ambition to advance within the system of education. It's because this is actually what is meaning to us. This is actually what's important to us. You know, and then you begin to look around and you begin to think, well, yes, I mean, there are lots. You can think of big cracks, you can think of the Zapatistas, you can think of Oaxaca, you can think of Buenos Aires in 2001, 2002, you can think of 1968, there's a lovely big crack. You can think on and on and on, or you can think of little, you know, medium cracks or little cracks. You can think of autonomous radio stations. You can think of alternative education experiments. You can think of community gardens. You can think of all sorts of things that go in the wrong direction. And then you begin to think, well, yes, okay. And sometimes these cracks are territorial. You know, sometimes they mark out a clear territorial space. And like they say, well, yeah, okay, here there's a Zapatista area, or here Oaxaca, or here in Sukoti Park, or whatever. You know, here we've got a little space. Or you can think of it, but you don't have to think of it, seems to me, in territorial terms. You can think of it in terms of time. You can say, well, okay, we live in a society in which there are all sorts of pressures that push us to conform. But even in that context, we can say no. There are times in which we will express our fury, times in which we will express our search for something else. You know, here we are, meeting for a couple of hours. That's a temporally defined crack, I suppose. But one that we hope spills over and over and over and over. Or you can think of it as being activity related. You can say, well, okay, we live in a capitalist society. We live, at least for the moment, unfortunately, in a society in which products are sold as commodities. But water, no. No way will we accept the commodification of water. No. And then you rise up. Like the people in Cochabamba in the year 2000, in the war again, the war of water, and say, no, we will not accept the privatization of water. And they won. Or you rise up like the students of the UNAM, the main university in Mexico City, and again 1999, 2000, and saying, well, no, we will not accept the introduction of fees, because that is the first step towards the privatization of public education. And they fought and they fought, and they went on strike for a year, for 11 months. And in the end, they were repressed, but they won on that point. And since then, no rector has even dared to mention the possibility of introducing fees. So you begin to look around, and you begin to see, well, in fact, no. We were right to start with we. We were right to start with overflowing. We were right not to start with domination, because when you look at the world, you actually see that the world is full of cracks, that it's full of these spaces of rejection, of refusal and creation, in which people push in the opposite direction. And I suppose one thing that characterizes all these cracks is really that in those spaces, in those moments, in those activities, people are saying, people are saying here, in this space, in this moment, in relation to this, we reject the integration of our activity into capitalism. We reject the logic of alienated labor. We reject the logic of abstract labor. We reject the logic of value. We reject the logic of money. Here we shall do what we consider to be desirable, what we consider to be necessary. So at the core of these spaces, these cracks, there is actually a revolt of doing against labor. And I talk of, obviously, you know, this is something we're all aware of. I mean, all these things have been developing and growing. They've been there all the time, but I think they've been developing with a new confidence over the last 20, 30 years. And we have all sorts of names for them. No, we talk about them as autonomies, as autonomous spaces. We can talk about them as dignities. You know, here we raise the flag of dignity and go in the opposite direction. We can think of them as being no-go areas, areas in which we will not allow the capital to dominate, in which we will not allow money to dominate. Yeah. And we do it all the time. We do it also in our personal lives. In a sense, that's what we mean by love, and that we have we won't allow, if we love somebody, if we love our children, love our partner, whoever, you know, we're saying, well, here, it's a different logic. We're not going to relate to our children or our loved ones on the basis of money. We're not going to try and think, you know, how will we get a good price for our children? We don't usually, you know. You know, so that is it. That is part of the pushing in the opposite direction, which is profoundly rooted in our everyday experience. Or you can talk of them as, you know, Chris Carlson does, as nowtopias. Or you can talk of them as Rebecca Solnit does, but also as, you know, the concept that's associated with the whole history of gardening, for example, as paradises. Or you can talk of, you know, you can think of them as being the idea that the way we protest, or the way we fight, is not just by looking for gradual reform, but it is by kind of lifting an area of experience or a territorial area or whatever, lifting an area out of capital and trying to, within that area, creating something else. You know, and we're raising, in a way you can think of it as being, you know, raising so many banners of a different world. Or creating so many lighthouses that kind of illuminate and shine onto the world around them. and inspire people. And I think that I talk about cracks. The reason I like talking about cracks rather than autonomies, I think, is for me, cracks suggest movement. Cracks move all the time. They expand. They get covered over. They get plastered over. They open again. They join up. They're in constant movement. Whereas the danger thinking in terms of an autonomous space, or the danger, in fact, in the practice of autonomous spaces, is that they can become closed in on themselves. And once they cease to move, then they cease to break, they cease to be ruptured. So that's why I talk about cracks, but we don't have to call them what you like. Okay, so if we see, and if that corresponds to, I think, a big, to what has been happening in the anti-capitalist struggle over recent years, what we can say is that this is really the basis of a different way of thinking about revolution. We can begin to say, well, if we're going to pose the question of revolution again, we have to pose it not in terms of how we're going to take power, that didn't work, not in terms of taking state power, that didn't work. We now have to think of revolution in terms of the creation, expansion, multiplication, and confluence of these cracks. And another way of, I suppose, saying that is that we have to think of revolution. We have to think of it as being interstitial. In other words, we can think of revolution as being complete transformation of the whole world from one day to another, that it actually has to be. We have to think in terms of an interstitial process, a process of multiple ruptures. And we have to think that capital won't be killed by a dagger thrust to the heart. It'll actually be killed by millions and millions of bee stings, if you like. We are the bees that are stinging it, and they're going to keep on stinging it until it dies. But then if you say, well, revolution has to be interstitial, in a sense that is, obviously that has also always been true. The whole notion of taking state power was also an interstitial concept of revolution. You take control of one state, and then you take control of another state and another state, which is very clear. For example, in the Trotskyist idea of permanent revolution, the rejection of the idea of socialism in one country. Of course, revolution has to be interstitial. But I think what is emerging now, I think, is the awareness that we have to think of these interstices, or these spaces, or these cracks, autonomies, as being our spaces. It doesn't work if we pour our rebellion into the organizational forms created for the reproduction of capital. Because to pour our rebellions into the state form, if you like, into capitalist forms, means to expropriate ourselves. It means to exclude ourselves from our own rebellion. I was in Bolivia about 5-6 years ago, and I very much that feeling there as well. After the election of Evo Morales and the mass government, after the whole upsurge of rebellion from 2000 to 2005. What was happening, of course, was exciting. But it was a revolution expropriated. It was a process that had actually been taken away from the people who were creating it, or who had created the basis for it. And I think that's become ever more clear since then. Okay, so not through the state. If we're talking about cracks, we're saying no, the cracks have to be our cracks, our forms of organization, our rethinkings of social relations. And if we say no to the state, and this is really fundamental, if we say no to the state, then we shoot clocks. No? There's this lovely thing of Walter Benjamin, no, where he, his thesis on whatever it is, on philosophy of history, where he says that in 1848, you know, the first thing that the workers did in the uprising of 1848 in Paris was they went out and they shot the clocks. They took out the guns and fired at the clocks in the towers. And yeah, I mean, in other words, that if we can say not through the state, then we have to rethink time. Because the state implies a certain concept of time. If we think of revolution as taking place through the state, then inevitably we think of revolution as being in the future. We think of the future revolution, no? With capital F and capital R. No. And we build for the glorious day. We build the party, we build the organization, we perhaps build the army, whatever, but we are building for the future. When we will take power, and then we will bring about change. And I think that what is happening at the moment is exactly the opposite. No? That the idea of creating cracks means creating revolution here and now. We don't wait. We can't wait. No. The idea of, there might be a socialist revolution in 50 years' time or in 100 years' time. Well, of course, we won't live to see it, but perhaps our children or our grandchildren. That idea is absolutely insane. It's insane because who knows if humans will still exist in 100 years' time for a start off if we don't do something to change the system. And that's it, ridiculous. And which we have to think of revolution as being here and now. And I think that's exactly what the cracks are doing. The cracks are saying, well, here in our little area, perhaps we're mad, perhaps we're insignificant, but here and now we are going to transform things. Here and now we are going to do things in a different way. And that doesn't solve the problem, but I think what there is, in a way, if you think of the old traditional idea of revolution, there are two temporalities, aren't there? The first temporality is wait. Revolutionary patience, the virtue. It's always talked about the virtue of revolutionary patience. Wait until the conditions are right. Wait until we build our organization strong enough. This year we won, in the election we managed to get 1% of the vote. Next year it's going to be 2%. Maybe in 10 years' time we'll be up to 4%. So just a bit of revolutionary patience and we will get there at the end. No. So it's kind of the first temporality is the temporality of patience. And then, of course, when the great day comes, then complete transformation. And I think now with the cracks, we have a reversal of temporalities. Again, we have two temporalities, because the first temporality is here and now we change things. We change things because we cannot accept what's happening. Yeah, basta. Here and now, enough. And we start walking in the wrong direction. Here and now we start doing things in a different way. But I think there is also a second temporality, because we know perfectly well that just the fact that we start to walk in the wrong direction, it does not unfortunately mean that capitalism will no longer exist tomorrow. It may do. I'm not saying it necessarily will exist tomorrow, but at least we know that it doesn't necessarily mean that just because we walk in the wrong direction that capitalism will disappear. In other words, the Zapatista ya basta is complemented by another expression of theirs, which is we walk, we do not run, because we are going a long way. In other words, that there is behind the impatience, the refusal to say accept anymore, there is of course an arduous process of actually creating a different world. So if we ask, not just what clever ideas can we find about revolution today? But what is it that the struggles themselves are saying about revolution? Then I think what they're doing is that they're posing the issue of revolution not in terms of taking power, not in terms of party politics and winning elections, that they're posing the issue of revolution in terms of how do we break, how can we create spaces that go in the opposite direction, how can we break the social cohesion that lies so heavily upon us, how can we break the social synthesis within which we live, how can we break this totality that sucks us all in so awfully, so unbearably, so horribly all the time. You know, we know we rebel, we know we want to do something different, and all the time there's this horrible sucking noise that pulls us back into the logic of the system. How can we break that? How do we think about revolution? Not as, I think now this is the issue, not how do we think of it as the replacement of one totality by another totality, which was the old idea, I think. Okay, you break capitalism, you create a different total social system. Okay, you get rid of capitalism and you install planning, no? Socialist planning, which is going to be coordinated, obviously initially at least through the state. No. How, in other words, the idea was to replace one totality with another. And I think what's happening now is that we're saying, no, that's not the issue. The issue is really, how do we de-totalize? How do we break that totality? Not in order to create one other totality, but to create, perhaps, who knows how it's going to work out, but to create, at least for the moment, a multiplicity of social patterns or social cohesions. In other words, what we want is a world of many worlds. And if you want, you can see that. I mean, if you're kind of into those debates, you can see it in terms of Adorno's critique of Lukács. You know, his idea precisely saying, you know, Lukács was wonderful, but of course he was into the Leninist Party and saw things very much from the point of view of totality and understood, you know, that was the central category for him. Adorno's critique was, no, absolutely not. That's really just to reproduce a repressive system. Okay, so the issue now, I think, is not how do we replace one totality with another, but how do we de-totalize? How do we actually think of a world that unleashes its energies or unleashes our creativity in different directions? How do we uncouple ourselves from the dynamic of death? And then what is it? If I suppose one way of thinking about it is to think, well, what is, you know, when we think of creating autonomies or autonomous spaces or cracks, what are the forces we come up against? You know, and obviously the most obvious force is the violence of the state. Again, I was being told a little while ago about the repression in Oakland, or the repression here in San Francisco, now I understand, the 12th of October. Was it? You know, and obviously, that's what the police are about, in a sense. They're about trying to impose a social logic. That's what law and order means. It means that how do we make you fit into the system? How do we repress attempts to misfit collectively? How do we repress attempts to break the logic of the system? A And that, of course, is one great order of problems. I mean, how do we deal with that? But behind that, it seems to me that there is another, there's a greater force, of social cohesion, which is the force of money or the force of value. I mean, what maintaining law and order is about, basically, is how do you maintain favorable conditions for investment in southern San Francisco? Well, obviously, by keeping people quiet, by getting them off the streets, by not allowing San Francisco to acquire the image of a place of rebellion. But the force behind the policing is the logic of money. How do we integrate San Francisco as favorably as possible into a world in which it is the logic of money that dominates the logic of profit? Or, if you want to, obviously, what Marx does is to say, well, if we want to go behind the logic of money, if we want to understand this logic of money, we have to go a step. We have to break the surface of that and see that this logic of money, in fact, expresses the logic of value. And what value is about, or what determines the magnitude of value, as we know, is the amount of socially necessary labour time required to produce a commodity. But not just socially necessary labour time, but labour time of a particular type, not just the amount of dancing or kissing or jumping up and down that is required to produce the commodity, but the amount of value-producing labour. In other words, the amount of abstract labour, the amount of alienated labour. Okay. So behind money, behind the movement of money, behind the logic of money, is the logic of abstract labour, the logic that pushes our activity as humans into a certain form. And it seems to me it's important to come back to that. It's important to think. I mean, well, that was the argument yesterday. No, it's important to think our politics from ourselves, from our activity. Of course, one of the slogans, I suppose, over the last 20, 30 years has been the idea of a politics of use value, that we will try and look at things in terms of their utility rather than in terms of their profitability. I think we have to go beyond that and say, well, no, our strength isn't visible at the level of value. Our strength is visible at the level of labour, at the level of the contradictory character of labour, at the level of our ability, not only our ability, but our daily practice of trying to break the logic of abstract labour all the time. Where we're saying, well, okay, it imposes all sorts of constraints and limits upon us, but we will not necessarily follow that logic. We will not necessarily make all our actions conform to that logic. Our real strength is in doing something else, in walking in the opposite direction. So then, if we think, of behind, it's not just the problem of the police. Behind that, there is this more profound, more tightly integrated force, which is the force of money, which is ultimately the force of abstract labour. If we ask, well, how do we break that force? Then, of course, we are beginning to get an answer by saying, well, the way to break that cohesion is actually to do in a different way, to try and think from our own revolts against abstract labour. How can we break that logic? And two points just to finish. The first long point First is that the social cohesion within which we live, this society, this kind of tight weave within which we live, is obviously not total. You know, at times we think it is, at times we think it's all domination, it's all money, that there's nothing that can be done. But the very fact that we perceive that domination, the very fact that we criticize it, means that that is not true. Okay? We can say, oh, well, we are very special, we're the cleverest people in the world, that's why we can understand that. But if we don't want to say that, if we say, well, no, in fact, the fact that we can see it actually indicates that social cohesion is not as tight as it appears. That beside that social cohesion is a constant movement against that cohesion. Behind money, there is a constant movement against money. Behind value, there is a constant movement against value and for the creation of other values. If we think that, then we begin to say, well, no, of course, we've been talking about that. They're the cracks. No, that's precisely what we've been saying, that the cohesion is not as tight as we thought. And then we think, well, of course, I mean, the cohesion isn't really a cohesion. It's not a noun. That's a false image. It's a verb. It's a cohering. No? It's a cohering. It's a kind of a weaving together that is constantly going on, that is constantly tying us in. But we, at the same time, are constantly moving in the opposite direction. So then we begin to see, yes, of course, that means that money is a struggle. It's not a thing. It's a struggle to push us into certain forms of behavior. Value is not a thing. It's a struggle to push us into certain forms of behavior. Capital is not a thing. It pushes us into certain forms of action. And we begin to dissolve the world from being a world of nouns that weighs so heavily upon us, and we begin to think of the world as a world of verbs. And once we begin to think of the world as a world of verbs, we're beginning to open up spaces. The other thing I wanted to say is that if we think then of this is both terrible, but it's also the source of hope, I think. If we think of this social cohesion or social cohering as being established through the form of money or through the form of value, then we can see not only is it a constant struggle, but it is a constantly intensifying struggle. In other words, the significance of abstract labor or the significance of value production is not the same today as it was yesterday. And that's very obvious if you think, well, if I were to make a car today in the same way as, say, 50 years, would I be producing value? Of course not. Might be fun as a hobby, but you certainly wouldn't be producing something that would sell on the market. You wouldn't be producing value. To produce a car costs a lot less time today than it did 50 years ago. The meaning of abstract labor changes from day to day. The meaning of value production changes from day to day. The very fact that it is the socially necessary labor required to produce something that determines its value means that capital is a constant movement of faster, 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 and the constant extension of its control over the whole of society, a constant tighter, tighter, tighter control. And that, on the one hand, is awful, because it means a constant process of dehumanizing, of humiliating, of pushing us down onto our knees. But it also means a constant process of rebellion. It's not rebellion against something that is there. It's rebellion that grows out of resistance against an attack upon us. No. And that's what, in a way, both what is horrifying about the situation. But it is also, it seems to me, where hope lies, because it is, since capital won't let us sit still, since, certainly being a university professor today is nothing like it was when I first started teaching in the university. And that can be said, I think, of any job, or any, same for students. You know, writing a PhD today isn't at all the same as it was 30 years ago. And that's because we suffer from this constant attack, this constant pressure. You know? And that pushes us to rebel, that pushes us more and more to say, yeah, basta. Say more and more, no, enough. This is insane. We have to do things in a different way. We have to walk in the opposite direction. And I think it's this faster, 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 this tighter, tighter, tighter control, this dynamic, this insatiable dynamic of capital. That is what is in crisis today. Now, and the question then is, how do we understand that we are that crisis? And how do we kind of think about the possibilities of revolutionary politics from that standpoint? And that's what I wanted to say today.